This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there, welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, very best bits of today's show from Tuesday, March the 16th, lovingly curated by producer Shruti and the noisy Isa Habibio as well. Shruti, good morning.
Morning.
So, big focus on the role of women in the boardroom this morning, because the problem is there are so few of them.
Yes, and a new regulation that suggests that it's not yet decided if it's a directive or a guideline, but it's about encouraging more women to be in the boardrooms in the UAE companies.
Yeah, it says as a minimum, every listed company has to have at least one woman on the boardroom. We're going to hear from a bunch of people in the podcast. We're going to hear from the guys at Aurora 50, which is a social enterprise in Abu Dhabi that's done a bunch of research on this, and also Amina Taha, who is herself an independent board member of DXB Entertainment's Emirati executive. Also going to hear from Sky Kurtz. Love Sky. Love the work he's doing. Love his tomatoes.
Yes, $60 million, wasn't it? The funding?
There is.
Oh.
But it's not equity funding, it's debt funding, which is very rare for a startup. So it's kind of pioneering. And as ever, Sky is brilliant and eloquent in describing what he's doing and why this matters, essentially expanding across the Gulf. Going to talk population as well, because interesting new stats out from Dubai Statistics Office that say the population of Dubai increased last year.
Yes, and we spoke to Daniel Richards about this and we got his view, his take on this. And, you know, he also mentioned, and we discussed this as well, that anecdotally, we know a lot of people have left. So we did wonder where this number came from. But we got a text that was really interesting and it said, have you considered the baby boom because of COVID? And, you know, that makes sense because that does add to the population as well.
Could be that. Yeah, producer Mohammed was part of that, wasn't he?
Yes.
He had a baby in December. Good on you, Mo. We're talking air travel as well. Really encouraging stats out of the US overnight. Shares of American Airlines, United Airlines, rising sharply on the back of not only more people flying now, but bookings for summer are really, really strong. So we'll hear from one of those CEOs. And finally, Colin McLaughlin at Dubai Duty Free. What a tough year for him and his team, and yet dutifully sponsoring still this year the tennis championships.
Yes, he mentioned that they've been sponsoring the men's tournament of the Dubai Duty Free Tennis Championship for the last 29 years. That's almost as long as I've been alive. That is incredible.
which is fine in a normal year because Dubai Duty Free makes a lot of money. This year, of course, very, very different. So we're going to hear from Colm, not just about sports sponsorship, but what's he done with all the Toblerones?
Yes.
He's been talking to Tom. But right now, let's dive into our big talking point today, which is the role of women in UAE boardrooms.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
New rules out from the Securities and Commodities Authority this week stipulate that every company listed on the stock market must have at least one woman in their board of directors. And this is much needed because, as we've been reporting, just 3.5% right now of board positions are held by women here in the UAE. Joining us on the line now is one of those that already does hold that position. Now, Amina Taha's day job is vice president with Etihad Aviation Group in Abu Dhabi, where she heads up brand, marketing and partnerships. But since 2007, she's also been an independent director of DXB Entertainment. Amina, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Richard, and good morning, UAE. And thank you for literally hearing my voice on this topic. I'm absolutely overjoyed by the announcement. The 14th of March will forever be marked in my calendar as a milestone in the empowerment of women across the UAE. And honestly, I really believe in the idea that if you can envision it, you can be it. So hopefully with more women represented on these boards, we inspire future generation and create positive role models for young girls, including my daughter, Shamma. And this announcement helps build a strong pipeline of future female talent here in the UAE.
So if we rewind a little bit, what's the problem that's been stopping this happening so previously? It seems obvious that so many talented women here in the UAE, you would have thought companies would have been queuing up to have women on their boards of directors, as DXB Entertainments did with you. Why has it not happened before now, Amina?
I think simply we didn't have an organization such as Aurora 50. So I want to actually start by thanking Aurora 50 and the Central Bank of the UAE. Because of them, we will see more high-performing, gender-balanced boardrooms in the UAE. So for those who are listening and don't know what's Aurora 50, I would describe them as a bold social enterprise founded by two awesome women, Her Highness Sheikha Shamma bin Sultan bin Khalifa Al Nahyan and Diana Wild. And their whole purpose is to drive change, push boundary, and solve such problems, but most importantly, empower women in our region.
Well, we spoke to Diana a little bit earlier on this morning, and if people want to hear that interview, we'll hear from her a little bit later on, and it will be also on the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast. But let's talk about your experience, because you have, maybe we could say, broken through the glass ceiling when it comes to boards of directors. Back in 2007, you were appointed as an independent director of DXB Entertainment. That's, what, 3.5 years ago now. What does the role actually entail, Amina?
So Richard, it's 2017. Actually, when you sit in a board, you represent, obviously, the shareholder. But in addition to that, as women, you also represent women. And the things that you do, one is you bring a different perspective, you bring your leadership, and you bring your knowledge and experience into the table. And I'm so glad that we're going to have more women to have voices in that top table.
There's a debate that's raged internationally for a while. Is it valid to say that women bring a different style of management and leadership to corporate settings, whether that's in the C-suite or management or in board of directors roles? Do you have a view on that?
No, absolutely, 100%. Also, we know from research, Richard, that we research worldwide that increasing gender diversity in boardrooms has a positive and significant effect on the financial performance of companies. And I don't know if you've seen, like, a recent study in the UK also proved that when you actually have an executive board that's 1/3 female, the business is 10 times more profitable on average than all male boards. So definitely it contributes to the financial performance, but also the leadership that women bring, especially when it comes to authenticity and empathy, adds so much for the organization, but also for the shareholder.
So in terms of what happens next, we've got this new ruling from the regulator that says there has to be at least one woman on each board of directors. But how do companies go around finding the right talent? Because as you know, Amina, this can't just be tokenism and filling quotas, can it? It's got to be done well.
No, absolutely. Richard, the UAE is a country that recognizes and celebrates diversity. And as a nation, we understand that there is a strength in our differences. So not just our gender, but our cultures, our experiences, and our skills too. And diversity means opening up possibilities for a greater number of skilled women to be representative on board and avoid the unfortunate situation of having the same individual incumbent on board over many years. It's like any club. You need more people to join the party to bring fresh ideas and more color to enjoy the dance. And honestly, in the UAE, we have an oversupply of talented and experienced women, be it Emirati or expats.
Finally, and I know you started off by talking about your family and what this means for your daughter in her future career, but you also said to me yesterday you wished your late grandmother was around to see this, because you think it's a landmark, not just for business, but for the UAE, for the country.
Yeah, Richard, my grandmother was illiterate. She unfortunately left us last year. She was promoting education and, you know, for women and for myself and my cousins to kind of continue further education. So honestly, I wish my late grandmother could see just how far we've come. And I know she would have been immensely proud and overjoyed by what women have achieved and what the UAE has done to help us get there.
Well, congratulations on being a trailblazer. You've been a member of the board of directors of DXB Entertainment since 2017. Thanks very much indeed for joining us today. We'll let you get back to your day job at Etihad Aviation Group. That's the voice of Amina Taha.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Where we're looking at the role of women in the boardroom here in the UAE, because we have a problem. There are not enough of them, particularly when it comes to listed companies. Research from Aurora 50 says just 3.5% of board positions here in the UAE at listed companies are held by women. Thankfully, help is at hand in the form of new rules and regulations that stipulate that at least one board member must be female at all listed companies going forward. This initiative has been driven by a couple of organisations, including Aurora 50. It's a social enterprise down the road in Abu Dhabi. Diana Wild is the co-founder, and we've been speaking to her about it this morning. And we began by asking her, this new ruling from the Securities and Commodities Authority, one woman minimum per board of directors, is it just a guideline or is it a directive?
This is a change from what was previously in place. As I said previously, it was a case that you could comply or you could just explain. This now does put that enforcement in place, but you will have to have one woman on your board.
Now, the criticism that schemes like this, quotas, are just tokenism. She rejects that argument. We asked her why.
Sure. So we definitely say that this isn't tokenistic. There's been a lot of work over the last couple of years to ensure that there are women within the pipeline. When we looked at the issue, and we've been working very closely with ESCA and with partners like ADNOC and Mubadala, what we're seeing is that there are women in the pipeline, but that the ecosystem is imbalanced. So it's basically harder for the boards to actually find those women than it is for them to nominate men. So this is really going to help us in terms of changing the amount of effort that goes into that process.
Now, there's also discussion in the literature on whether there really is a difference in leadership style between women and men. I asked her, what does the evidence tell us about this?
I think what's very interesting about that point is that when this comes to boards, what we're really looking for is diversity of thought. Those characteristics can be seen in both men and women. The reality, though, is that at this point in time, we don't have those female voices in the boardroom. And so we need to take conservative efforts to actually ensure that those nominations are going in so that women have that opportunity and we have that diversity of thought in the boardroom.
Finally, I asked her about research from Harvard Business Review that suggests that in terms of management and leadership within organizations, women come slightly ahead of men. There's the headline in Harvard Business Review: women score higher than men in most leadership skills. About 10,000 employees were surveyed and asked to give 360-degree feedback on their managers. And they were judged on issues such as, or metrics such as, displays high integrity and honesty, resilience, bold leadership, and champions change. And on 15 out of those 17 metrics, women were slightly, not massively, but slightly ahead of men. I asked Diana for her thoughts on that.
In some ways, yes, we do hear this a lot. But I think the point about boards is that we're looking at how that group of individuals actually work as a team. And what actually happens when you put men and women in the room together is that the collective intelligence actually goes up. So this isn't really an argument in terms of one sex being better than the other. It's the fact that we're going to make better decisions when you have diversity of thought in that room. And that's why it's so important that we're not just looking at half of the talent pipeline. We have to have access to both the men and the women.
Diana Wild from Aurora 50, co-founder there. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
And speaking of commodities, let's talk agriculture now. Looking in more depth at one of our top news stories this morning, Pure Harvest Smart Farms securing $60 million in funding. Very pleased to speak again to Skye Kurtz, co-founder and CEO of Pure Harvest Smart Farms. Skye, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Always great to speak with you, Brandy.
Emma Brooke, congratulations on your latest fundraising round. What are you raising money for, Skye? What are you looking to do?
We are funding expansion. You may be aware, but we're building currently two projects here in the UAE, another project in Saudi Arabia, and then we've secured and made public a very large project in partnership with the Sultan Center in Kuwait. It's the largest independent retailer, and fundamentally we're funding some of the early investment needed to design and develop that very large facility, as well as we've secured a set of incentives from the Abu Dhabi Investment Office that support research and development and further developing our technology and capability, as well as building out our team. And that requires investment, of course, as well. So really, it's expansion, research and development, and increasing and building our strong team. A lot of exciting growth ahead.
You're not the only one making growth puns this morning. We're interested this morning not just in the money you've raised, but the way that you've raised it, because $50 million of this is a structured sukuk, so an Islamic bond. Why have you gone that route?
Well, good question. Ultimately, it was led by our partners Shua and Sancta, as well as Franklin Templeton. But the Islamic finance market is a very deep market in this region, as you can imagine, but of investors that are seeking, you know, kind of yield, a very yield-hungry investor base. And the fact that we build property, plant, and equipment lends very well to this type of a financing structure, because it's like a bond, but it's heavily predicated upon assets. So this is an exciting opportunity for us to tap a deep and new investor base, but also to put a reference security out there. That now that we have an exchange-traded bond, this is one step farther toward accessing more mature institutional capital markets, and also ones that are very deep. But of course, now that we've tapped it, we hope to be able to tap that market again. So it's really an important milestone for the company in accessing larger and more sophisticated capital markets. Now, the other thing I want to mention, though, Brandy, this is sort of venture debt, which is quite unusual in this region. And I think it shows the vision of our partners. They saw a promising, you know, startup or now SME and really believed in the economics and in the success of its early build. And then, of course, were willing to help back and support its expansion that, hey, if the first box works, the others will work in larger capacity. And doing the work, you know, pulling up their sleeves to do the credit work to get comfortable on that. So I think it was really a team effort. And now my hope is that this opens a market for other startups and SMEs that are growing and they can tap credit markets, which help, you know, lower cost funding to help fast growing companies achieve their ambitions.
Well, as you mentioned there, the asset-based nature of an Islamic bond might make you more attractive to people who otherwise wouldn't invest in you. Are you finding new investors on the back of this? Does this open up a new pool?
Certainly it has. I mean, if you look within even the announced investors in this group, I mean, parties like Sancta, which is a, you know, an opportunities fund based out of DIFC, a very sophisticated, you know, pool of capital, and Franklin Templeton, one of the largest fixed income managers in the world, you know, representing billions and billions of capital. So we are tapping into an entirely new investor base and ones that are, you know, that really have the dry powder to support further expansion because fundamentally our business is capital intensive. And as we want to secure new projects, which we're very keen to do, we ultimately have to fund those projects. So yes, this is an exciting opportunity for us, but I would also encourage other SMEs to look at it and to look at such funding opportunities because the traditional bank market here doesn't really serve startups and SMEs. You guys have covered this on your show before. But I think that now there are alternative markets open to that. And I think it shows, Brandy, we're kind of a representative, you know, microcosm, if you will, of what's happening in the capital markets here. Venture funds continue to emerge. A government program supporting SMEs and growth continue to emerge. And then now credit markets are catching up and starting to support that. So really this shows a very good maturation of the capital markets supporting SMEs and startups, which is a critical, you know, leg of the stool, if you will, of the vision toward economic diversification, right? There needs to be capital available to companies like ours and others to be able to build if they want to ultimately achieve their ambitions toward diversifying the economy.
Is that capital not coming from the banks, though, in your experience?
Absolutely not. And I'll openly say it. No, banks typically don't lend in this region and certainly in the UAE to companies that are early stage, right? I mean, even one of the basic requirements in most lending is that you have 3 years of operation and typically profitable operation. Well, for a startup, that can be, you know, 5 to 7 years into its life, right? You're not really a startup anymore. So I would say traditional lending to, you know, SMEs is quite limited. Now, there are government incentives, and particularly post-COVID, that have emerged to help to kind of bear some of that credit risk, sort of guarantee schemes that help the banks to extend credit, and that's working. The Emirates Development Bank is doing a lot of innovative things to try and now start to support lending to startups and SMEs. Audio, obviously, is investing, and there's some activity, but really a lot of this is government-led, less so from the traditional banks and kind of institutional lending market. However, something like our financing, and also there are innovators like you've probably heard of Beehive, a startup out of BIFC, I believe you covered them, and Beehive is now, you know, tapping into kind of lending directly to companies from individuals, right, and kind of circumventing the traditional lending market. Well, the reason these things are happening is traditional banks don't typically lend to startups in this region, and really without that, they're left only to get, you know, very expensive equity capital for every stage of their growth, and that limits the prospects of these companies. And admittedly, it disadvantages us versus markets like Europe and America.
So what is the cost of the capital that you have raised here then? What's the downside, Sky, to this story?
Yeah, well, I guess downside or upside. So it's either expensive debt or cheap equity, depending on how you perform, is the way we think of it. But it isn't low-cost capital, right? This is venture debt. They're lending against the prospects and execution of our scale-up into new crops because in our plant, in our operations here, we're scaling up our tomato production significantly, scaling up our strawberry production significantly through a retrofit of our existing asset, And then we're building a new leafy greens operation. And we'll be supplying nearly 70 to 75 tons a week of production out of these combined assets when they're done. That's just the UAE. That doesn't count the Saudi operations. So this is a significant scale up, and these partners are taking credit risk, right? Underwriting the management team, our proof of concept, our brand, our early market entry and strength. But make no mistake, there's still execution risk, right? So this capital reflects that. So that said, it's sort of a teens return profile. However, if we ultimately are successful in scaling that up, and then ultimately you would replace that capital, it is far cheaper than equity, right? So this is really advantageous to a company like ours to secure, you know, both debt and equity to help build. And imagine this, Brandy, we are a technology-enabled agribusiness that's heavily having to fund glass, steel, and infrastructure using equity capital, right? That isn't sustainable. As we're now maturing, we're increasingly looking toward both new models, so opco, propco structures where our partners help finance the assets we design, build, and operate them, and then looking toward non-dilutive but kind of institutional capital markets like infrastructure, export credit agency finance, and, of course, bond markets like the one we tapped today.
Skye Kurtz, co-founder and CEO of Pure Harvest Smart Farms, thank you very much for your time this morning, chatting to us about the $60 million that they have just raised, $50 million of that, in a structured souk. And quite a frank conversation there, Richard, about the fact that it's not the cheapest money that you could raise, but it is the money that's on the table.
And it's cheaper than equity. Yeah, we talk so much about venture capital funds investing in startups buying equity, but Skye says debt needs to be part of the mix as well.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We've got quite a few numbers out this morning that we have been looking at. Amongst those, we've got population figures that have come out from the Dubai Statistics Centre saying that we actually saw growth in the Dubai population last year, an extra 55,000 odd people, up around 1.6% population-wise. We've been asking Daniel about those figures.
The Dubai Statistics Centre has released its demographic report for the year and estimates that Dubai saw population growth of 1.6% last year, increasing by some 55,000 to around 3.41 million people. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that this is an estimate, and it does seem a little at odds with what we saw in terms of reports of the number of expatriates leaving as they lost their jobs at the peak of a pandemic crisis last year. The PMI survey data would also have led us to believe that the population might have declined, given that the employment subcomponent on the Dubai Index came in under the neutral 50 level throughout last year, indicating a decline in jobs. Schools also reported a decline in enrolments last year, which would also suggest that the population declined. Nevertheless, if Dubai actually managed to secure population growth under such trying circumstances, it would be testament to the appeal and dynamism of the city.
There you go, Daniel, weighing in on those population figures there. The other numbers that we have had out have come from the Dubai Land Department. Some record numbers seen when it comes to house sales and mortgages in January.
We also had some data released by the Dubai Land Department, which was also encouraging in terms of Dubai's economic recovery from last year, as there was an increase in activity in the real estate sector in January and February. Real estate sales reported growth of 17% in January compared to January last year. And there are also a record number of new mortgages signed that month with a value of 20.9 billion dirhams, the highest since 2016. Real estate transactions, meanwhile, hit the highest level since March 2017. Now, there are a number of possible factors behind this, one of which could be a pickup in population growth. It could also be residual pent-up demand after a pandemic crisis led people to put any plans to move on hold last year. Or new owner-occupiers could be taking advantage of what could have been a bottom in terms of property prices. The real estate sector accounts for some 7 to 8% of total GDP, so a strong performance here would be good for a headline figure and for the economy more generally, especially given the sector's symbiotic relationship with construction, which is also an important component of GDP.
The thoughts of Mr. Daniel Richards,
Senior Economist, Emirates NBD.
Rich, let's go to the up there. What's happening with all things air travel?
It's picking up in the United States. Here's the headline on CNBC. Air travel jumps as vaccinations spur vacation bookings and stocks surge. It's one of our top stories today. American up 8% overnight on Wall Street. United up 8% overnight on Wall Street. This is data that comes out of what's called the TSA, the Transport Security Administration. They're the ones who do everyone who goes through a security checkpoint, and they count the numbers every day. Anyway, Sunday the number was 1.34 million people, and that is 86,000 more people than the same day a year ago. So flights right now, travel right now, is picking up. It's still 45% below where it was in 2019, but it's picking up. But the thing that's really got investors and others excited is revelations from, again, those airlines, United, American, about forward-looking bookings for the summer. Domestic leisure travel bookings are back to 2019 levels. Have a listen to this guy. He's Doug Parker. He's the CEO of American, talking about the rebound in leisure traffic.
Our last 3 weeks at American have been the three strongest weeks for bookings since the pandemic hit. And each week has been stronger than the last. So real momentum. It's largely leisure-based. You can see it in the TSA traffic data, but we can really see it in our bookings. The bookings are really quite strong. They're getting even close to 2019 levels at this point.
Which is great news for the aviation industry. There is some concern that with spring break coming up in the United States, very popular time for travel, it could lead to a further spike in coronavirus cases. America hasn't yet got herd immunity. Nevertheless, he and others are excited about the rebound in travel and bookings for the summer when America, it's hoped, will be close to herd immunity with the vaccination program. The one area that isn't picking up yet, and it's vital for all airlines because it's how they make the big bucks, is business travel. People up close to the pilot paying top dollar.
We're certainly seeing some green shoots. There is a small increase, but it's small. We really need what you said. We need companies to eliminate their restrictions on travel. We need people to return to work at least, some more than it is today. But look, that's going to happen. Just as we're seeing on the leisure side, there's huge pent up demand for business travel. We'll see business demand improve as well, and that's what's going to push our industry back to profitability.
It's Doug Parker. He's the CEO of American Airlines, talking to CNBC.
Interesting you mentioned there about herd immunity and the impacts that different sort of sporting events are having at the moment. We've talked to Carl McLaughlin. Interesting to get his media numbers out from last week. Absolutely blowing media numbers out from previous weeks. Obviously, more and more people watching online. But the other thing was, of course, the fact that the two more T20s over in, we were talking about the crowd the other day off air. Next to behind closed doors, they've decided enough's enough.
Yeah, the Gujarat Cricket Association just coming out with that in the last hour.
Yeah.
That's it.
Close the doors. Spike in numbers. No herd immunity.
No, 67,000 people at the ground a couple of days ago. Today there will be zero in Ahmedabad. That's the way the world is going.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
So let's turn attention to sport sponsorship amongst other events. Emirates Team New Zealand going very well down in the America's Cup at the moment.
Best headline I've seen this morning coming out of the New Zealand Herald: take a bow, lunar eclipsed.
Very good indeed. The creative juices flowing there, that's for sure. So, yeah, they're going very well at the moment down in the America's Cup in their own backyard, on their own waters. What about the challenges of sponsorship of other sports events around the world? None more so than right here in the UAE, where a number of organisations pride themselves on their long relationship with sporting events. Think tennis in the UAE, you think Dubai Duty Free. Long-term partners, long-time title sponsors and organisers of the women's and the men's tennis championships here in the UAE, and continue to do so again this year. And we've got the men in action this week as part of the ATP Dubai Tennis Championships, brought to you by Dubai Duty Free. The big guns take to the courts today as part of round of 32. Dominic Thiem, Andre Rublev, just a couple of some of the big names that are in town. Last week, though, it was, of course, the turn of the ladies for the women's draw, which was eventually won by the Spaniard, Garbine Muguruza, who was quick to praise Dubai Duty Free and the organisers.
I want to say that I'm so amazed by the effort of Dubai Duty Free and the tournament director, Salah, for doing this event in these circumstances with, the COVID, the no crowd, and, to give us a chance to play. That means a lot to us. So I'm very, very thankful for that.
Thankful indeed, and speaking on behalf of all of those that took part last week, let's get the thoughts now of the Executive Vice Chairman and the CEO of Dubai Duty Free, a man who needs little introduction. Carl McLaughlin joins us live on the line. Good morning to you, Carl.
Good morning, Tom. Nice to hear from you.
Really lovely to hear from you, my friend, as well. Just picking up on the thoughts there of Gobina. There she was, vocalising the appreciation, not just of her, the winner of the event, but the players in all, for getting the opportunity to play competitive tennis. Is that one of the guiding reasons that you've been so vocal in making sure that you stage the event again this year?
We were very happy to stage the event, Tom, and we had long discussions with the WTA and the ATP about doing it. And, of course, we complied with whatever guidance we had from the Supreme Committee for Safety and Standards and so on. And we're very happy to have been able to do it, although it was a big difference in comparison to other years.
In terms of just how close you came to saying, look, it is just not possible for us to stage the event this year, was that a conversation that was had amongst yourselves and the other bodies, or were you always very confident that you could stage it?
No, right since the beginning, we were very positive about having the tournament. And the whole thing, of course, is operated for us by an in-house committee we have with headed up by Ramesh Dambi and Salatalik, Sinead, Bernard Cree, they're our senior people. And right from the word go, we wanted to hold a tournament. And we had various discussions, of course, with the WTA and ATP. And they were also keen to have it and were very happy when we said very positively, yes, we're going to have the tournament in Dubai.
Obviously, it has been a tough
year. We've been doing the men's tournament for 29 years, and it would have been a pity to have a break in that, you know.
Yeah, it would have been a little strange, that's for sure. So,
Tom, when we did the draw for the men's tournament the other day, one of the notable things was that all the boys that came out in the draw were younger than our tournament. Many of them were not born when we started the tournament.
That's longevity.
I felt like a grandfather there.
That's longevity, that's for sure. To that end, I mean, the tournament is very different. You mentioned, you know, the very look, the feel is very different this year. But given the fact that you're over halfway through the event as a whole, are you happy with what you've been able to deliver thus far?
We're very happy, Tom, yes. And we have been praised largely by the WTA and the ATP for the procedures that are in place. You know, all the players are, for example, tested every 4 days. We have done at the Aviation Club and Jumeirah Creekside Hotel 2,000 tests since we started the whole thing. And there are safety precautions in place and procedures. There are dedicated areas for all the ATP and WTA players and staff, and they're in a bubble, as it were. There are dedicated dining areas for the players and officials, and we're still able to look after, well, no audience, of course, of people that are coming to the area because they're interested in tennis. Quick answer, yes, I am happy with the procedures and I am happy the way it has happened.
Dubai Duty Free is synonymous not just with tennis, golf, horse racing, so many other sports, not just here in the UAE but around the world. How tough is it at the moment for your sponsorship and marketing team, Colm, to be able to maintain those relationships moving forward?
It is very difficult because in each area there are different procedures. And, for example, horse racing last year in both England and Ireland were no spectators. Behind closed doors is a terminology that's used. And it is very different in total. In the case of the tennis, for example, you know, we had no revenue for ticket sales this year, and it was 7 or 8 million dirhams last year. And we had other costs that were incurred because of the procedures. And we're hoping that the return on viewership in around the world will be value to Dubai Duty Free. And if we take on that question, the value to Dubai Duty Free for our tennis championship last year was estimated at $1.5 billion. It looks like that's going to be exceeded considerably this year. And the information we have on the ladies tournament so far is that last week, worldwide, 27 million people saw Dubai and saw our tennis online. And that's a big increase over last year. You know, last year that same figure would have been 15 million. So it's almost 100% increase. And we're expecting the value of media coverage to Dubai this year to exceed last year's figure by a lot, and last year's figure was $1.5 billion. So there are all the positives that come out of it.
There is optimism, there is positives. We're even hearing optimism, positives about potential of aviation returning as well. One would assume, Colm, that goes hand in hand with the return of business for duty-free within airports as well. Are you seeing green shoots of recovery?
There are positive signs. The traffic, of course, is way down and will be way down this year. But a very positive thing that has come out of it is that because of the restrictions and because of people only having one opportunity to shop, our sale per head, for example, in duty-free has increased this year and last year. Last year, our average sale per head was about $38. This year, it's $52, $53, $54 in different months. So it's a very positive thing that's happening. And we're trying to identify exactly why and then make sure it's part and parcel of our operation forevermore.
Well, hopefully the tennis will be part and parcel of your operation forevermore as well. Really appreciate your time this morning, Colm. And just on that, congratulations to you and all the team. Tough times at the moment. Well done to you all for getting this tennis off the ground. We are all enjoying it very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much indeed. And it's a very different feeling, of course, no spectators, but the value is coming elsewhere.
Indeed.
And the stadium with no spectators looks fantastic.
It does look a picture, that's for sure. It looks amazing. Colm McLaughlin, we'll leave you to get back to the tennis. Colm McLaughlin there joining us live on the line. They continue their commitment to tennis here in the region and further afield. Colm is the Executive Vice Chairman and the CEO of Dubai Duty Free, the title sponsors of both the WTA and the ATP Women's and Men's Weeks, respectively, here in Dubai. Men's Week ongoing. Down at the Dubai International Tennis Stadium. You can watch it on Dubai Sports TV.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.